You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Lamb Goat presents the Van Flip Podcast.
What is up? Welcome to this episode of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Today I'm joined by Dominic Romeo. God.
Almost.
Almost got through it.
Yeah.
Do you go by Dom or Dominic?
Ah, it doesn't matter. Whatever you prefer is okay with me.
Cool. I'm just going to use short form because Dom is easier than Dominic.
He won't sound like my mom. It's good.
Okay. We won't be super formal on this podcast. How about that? Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, Dom has done a list of things. He's got a pretty interesting story. We'll get into that. But most currently, you are you're playing guitar in a band called In Rain. And you guys have an album coming out on the 14th of July through Relapse Records. The title of that album is The Way of All Flesh is Decay. And that's basically why you're on here today. But we're going to briefly talk about that right now. But I want to get into some other things about your past and, you know, what you've done, you know, in the last couple of decades. So, yeah, sure. In Rain. In Rain is kind of like this weird pseudo supergroup for, like, hardcore, you know. So how did that all come together?
It kind of came about as a pandemic project. I had an idea, a lot of time on my hands, and went through a very difficult stretch, as I'm sure a lot of people were. And I had this idea. I was bored. I was writing songs every day. I watched a lot of Kiss videos. Kiss is my favorite band. Kiss videos. And there's something Gene Simmons said once about how he writes a song every day, even if it sucks. And, you know, I'll leave the ratio up to the, you know, in the eye of the beholder of what that would entail. But I thought that was a cool idea. And I started writing a song every day. And the idea was to take the most interesting ones and send them to different people that I'm friends with and just, you know, just do them remotely, send them back and forth. And at the end, just dub a bunch of, like, Maxell cassettes, like an old mixtape. Like, you know, so like in the 80s, we would make each other tapes. Of all, like, stuff that we thought was the coolest, you know, and have, like, a handwritten cover where you draw some artwork and list the songs, whatever. And that was kind of, like, my idea. That's how it started. And about four or five songs into that, I sent Mike what was House of Thieves on the record. That Chromax record had just come out, that newish one, In the Beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I love anything that has Harley Flanagan and Rocky George on it. Count me in, you know. Great duo, in my opinion. And I was really excited about it, but kind of wished it sounded more like Best Wishes when it came out. And I was like, you know what? Me and Mike were just, you know, kind of talking. I'm like, what if, you know, if we were in charge, if we ruled the world, what would this record have sounded like? And that's how House of Thieves came together. We're like, let's write a song that sounds like Best Wishes. You know what I mean? Like that we thought would be cool. And we bounced it back and forth. Mike didn't really know how to use a recording interface at the time, so he just yelled into a pair of headphones. This was on the demo version of it. But, I mean, it came out awesome. It was really intense. I think Harley would approve.
Yeah.
You know, we just kind of went from there. We're like, let's do more songs. And that's when the mixtape kind of got off the rails, and the four or five songs I had started each spiraled off into their own band. So... And Rain ended up becoming its own whole different thing. So we did a bunch of songs. And we worked on that for about a year to my concept of time is shot. You know,
For sure.
I don't know, up from down most of the time. But yeah, so that was the idea. We just kind of bounced stuff back and forth. And then when I decided it was going to become a real thing, that we're going to go into a studio and record it, I had set a few rules for myself. Because... as a songwriter, I've always been a person that kind of, I take like a cinematic movie approach to when I make a record. There's like a definitive start, there's a definitive end to the record, and then I kind of fill the space in between with what the movie, if it was a movie, what the story would be, you know? It's a lot more like, it's a totally different approach than what I did with En-Rain. With En-Rain, I totally went AC/DC and just tried to go straight first chorus with everything. I wanted to, like, you know, challenge myself to do it differently. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big point of contention to make sure all the songs had verses, choruses, and were kind of structured in that classic format. And I think it did a great service in the end. But so with that in mind, We decided we're going to record at a place we never recorded before. That was my other rule. And that's when we decided to go to Len in New Jersey. He does Carmichael. He does Landmine Studios. It's out in Ewing. And Len's always just been here to help with like integrity stuff and pulling teeth stuff, like random little things I had to do in a pinch. He's always been there. And I'm like, you know what? I really like working with this guy. It'd be cool to, like, you know, go all in and try to do something together and see how it came out. And he was awesome. He was amazing. Real patient, because we're all like really, you know, ADHD, million things going on, old dudes that live all over the country. So it's like he was able to keep it all together for us, which was really cool. And then that takes us to the band guys, which was the drummer was first, was Adam Jarvis, who I worked together for years. We used to work at Guitar Center, like in the, the early to mid 2000s. Me, him, Mitch from Neolithic and Pulling Teeth.
Adam's in Pig Destroyer and Misery Index too, correct?
Yeah, and Scour and Lockup. He's like in every band. This was like when Pulling Teeth and Ruiner and like Misery Index were kind of like newish bands. I think Netherton and Sparky had just left Dying Fetus and started out. It was like, you know, it was like the early version of all. And we'd always be like, it'd be cool to start a band sometime. That was a great place to work. There's a lot of wild stories from there, that era.
Share one. Really, let's go. Let's get one. Let's get like an old school working at the music store story between you and Adam.
I mean, we used to just like, all right. So on the first day, I worked there, and you know, keeping my Mitch is like my little brother. He was a Pulling Teeth with me. He's like one of my best friends. So he gets me a job there because I needed something to do between tour. You know, it was like we're young dudes, don't really care. It's not really career driven. We just need, you know, a paycheck and health insurance. And you know, we get there on my first day, and he introduces me to our boss, and, you know, makes some smart-ass comment, like, you know, he's here, have him go clean the bathrooms, you know, and they're, like, joshing and ribbing and doing whatever the dudes do, and I'm like, and decided I was going to go into the bathroom and fill a rubber glove up with water, thinking that it would have the same effect that a water balloon would have.
Yeah.
If you were to water balloon at someone, you know, get soaked, and it's all good, but what I didn't know that a rubber glove is a different consistency and doesn't really work that way. So I went back and I'm like, bathroom's all clean. And then Mitch is like, you know, you should do this next. And him and my boss are laughing. I'm like, oh yeah, that's really funny. And I drove back and, you know, took a big swing at Mitch with this rubber glove, thinking it's going to just soak him in front of everyone. Everyone's going to laugh. But what ended up happening was the hand just got bigger, 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 and bigger, and just knocked Mitch across the room into the wall. This was my first day working there. First day my boss has ever met me. And the whole like reaction was just like,
yeah,
you know, just kind of like, who is this guy? Why do we hire him?
Thin ice already.
And, yeah, and from there it was just all out war. It was just like, you know, fake ads for different bands with Mitch's phone number. Mitch was usually like, you know, my target most of the time. I tried mailing him to another store once. It was a fun place to work. I don't think we got much actual work done.
Interesting.
But anyways, going back
to the lineups. You have Mitch, Adam.
Yeah. Jarvis was, you know, I texted him. I'm like, hey, would you want to do these songs with me? I'm bored. You know, I'm stuck in my house. I don't know what to do. And he's like, dude, I live like down the street from you. He literally lived like a block away from me at the time. And I had no idea because we hadn't talked in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we started getting together and hammering them out, which was great. Easy. He's a pro, you know. And so, yeah, the original plan was it was just going to be me and Jarvis recording all the music. I was going to do all the guitar and bass. That's what I did in Integrity most of the time. Mm-hmm. During my tenure with them, and that was it. And then, you know, a week before, I'm like, whoa, I already got Jarvis, I already got my score. If I could have anyone in the world play bass, who would it be?
Hey, what's up? It's Lurk. Looks like you're enjoying the podcast. If you are and you like what we're doing here on the Van Flip, why don't you go ahead and pause this and give us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to. If you want to find out any information on your favorite bands from the hardcore and metal scene, visit lambgoat.com. And to stay in the loop about everything that we post on lambgoat.com, make sure you like us on Facebook and you head over to Twitter and Instagram and follow us at lambgoat. Are you a full-grown adult and you also have a TikTok account? Congrats. Follow us on TikTok as well. You can find us under the username lambgoat.com. That's spelled out D-O-T-C-O-M. Head over to our YouTube channel where we have all of these podcasts in video format, plus a lot more content that you should check out. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and you hit that notification bell so you're always alerted when we upload new content. And last but not least, if you want to follow me, Lurk, the host of the show, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at LurkCity. And as always, if you need any of the links that pertain to the artists on the show today, Lambgoat, or myself, you can always find them in the description. Thanks for listening to this message. Now let's get back to the show.
You know, and I thought about it, I was too afraid to ask Harley. But I decided, you know, one of the greatest bass players, in my opinion, and most interesting musicians, most coolest bands from my favorite era of music, which, you know, is that 90s section of hardcore, was Art Legere from Bloodlet.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit him up and asked him if he would want to do it, and he was kind of iffy on it. And it was around that time Bloodlet and him parted ways. Bloodlet ended up reconfiguring their lineup. They needed guys that can actually go out and play.
Yeah.
Art's like a recluse. He doesn't leave the house much. And the guitar player had moved. So they were like in the middle of a shift of members and whatnot. And, you know, I was like, you know, it's going to really make those guys really get their goat. You know what I mean? You should come do this record.
Yeah.
But
some fuel to the flame there.
Yeah, you know, I had to lure him with a touch of evil. Oh, speaking of which, are you familiar with the Judas Priest song, A Touch of Evil?
Mm-hmm.
I've always wondered, is it like a touch of evil, or is it like a recipe? Is it like a touch of evil? Is he adding a touch of evil?
I think it's probably a touch of evil, like a recipe, right?
I like to think that, you know, he's in the kitchen. Not evil enough. Yeah. Calls for
a little touch. Just a dash, you know?
Yeah, just a pinch. These are the things that I think about.
Yeah, no, anyways, I get it. ADHD, I understand, man.
Coming back. So yeah, Art was like, you know, was all aboard. He learned all the songs in about a week. Came out and knocked everything out like a total pro. Me, him, and Jarvis went up to Jersey. We stayed about 4 days in this weird farmhouse that was in Pennsylvania, just outside of Ewing. And we just lived in the studio for like 4 days and knocked everything out. And the remaining period of time was, you know, we all work full time, have kids. I mean, most of us have kids, but we were never able to all be there at the same time. So it would be something where I would drive up, do a bunch of guitar stuff, and then Score would drive up and do a bunch of vocals, and we'd always crisscross and never really catch each other until mm-hmm. the end. We were able to get together once and hammer out all the little bugs and stuff that needed to be done. And then it came time for solos, and I was like, started doing, you know, my thing. I'm an okay guitar player when it's like doing Dom stuff, you know what I mean? I'm
right.
Dom, but I'm not like, you know, great by any means on the grand spectrum of things. And there was a lot of stuff I wanted to do that I'm not really physically capable of. And that song Chasing Divinity was the perfect example. So I'm like, man, I really gotta get someone that can do what I have in my head here. What, you know, who am I gonna ask? And Sebastian Phillips from Noisem and Exhumed came up because he's an old friend.
Yep.
I've known him since a little kid. He's a musical prodigy, you know? And I didn't even tell him what to do. I just sent him the song. And I go, tell me what you think. And what he sent back was so good that I like fell out of my seat laughing. It was like, just like, it was too perfect. It was exactly what I had in my head. And I was like, you have to join this band. I'll wipe out half of my solos and give you half of the space, the real estate, you know, do whatever you want. And everything he sent was amazing. You know what I mean? It was a perfect fit. So that's kind of how the story of how the band came together. You know, if you like our bands, you might think that's a cool story. If you don't know our bands, it's probably going to suck. But, you know, it's for, you know, for someone like me that likes all the bands that everybody was in, I think it's pretty cool. And maybe,
well, yeah, of course.
Maybe there's someone else out there too, you know?
Of course. And, is this like something, is this project something that you're going to like one day play live? Cause you were saying like Art's kind of like a recluse and, this, that, the other, and everyone lives separately and does other things outside of, you know, this project. But like, do you think one day you'll be, playing live shows, or is that in the near future?
We made a rule. It's like a pact when we did this, that there's gonna be no scabs ever. So it was either five of us or we're not going to do it.
Right.
Which also raised the bar really high as far as availability goes, because it's never available at the same time. So it's kind of open-ended, you know what I mean? If it works out, I would love it. There's nothing I would love more than to do it. But at the same time, you know, I liked SOD a lot more when they didn't play shows either. So yeah, it's like, I'd rather keep an air of mystery to it.
Kind of sounds, and, yeah. Kind of sounds like it's either that or just like some festival appearances here or there. It's,
you know, it's worked out the opposite. Because I feel like, you know, the and I think this has crossed over from regular society as well. It's just like, work harder, work more. Which is all fine and good, but then it's ended up being this huge homogenous pool of like endless availability. You know what I mean? There's nothing that's just like out of reach that's always going to be out of reach.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm probably one of three people that would care that it's out of reach. It's like, you know, so part of that is alluring to me, and I think that would be cool. But you know what? If the right opportunity comes along and the stars align and we're all available, sure, I would love that. Playing with those guys was a blast.
Interesting. So how does that, my next question was, how did you kind of link up with Relapse? Because you guys released some singles like last February, and then like in later in the year, August, September time frame, or in the fall or whatever, you guys announced, or Relapse announced, that you guys were signed to them. How does that play into, like, how does playing live play into that deal, or did, you know, were they aware of that prior to?
Well, they're aware going in. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's a very, I don't want to call it low maintenance in the sense that it's cheap in it, but as far as like low maintenance guys and expectations go, that's us. You know what I mean? We just were happy to have somebody put it out mm-hmm. and get it out there and get it to as many people as possible. And also Relapse and Translation Loss have a lot, have their hands in a lot of our previous bands. So they're kind of built in. And what I have going on with A389 and with Integrity at times is like, you know, it's all the hands are in the right pie, so to speak.
Yeah.
So
that's what I was going to ask. Cause like, obviously we were going to get into it, but you are A389 as well. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have at your disposal the ability to put the record out as well. So that was one of my other questions, was like as to why, you know, go with Relapse when you could put it out yourself, or what was the thought process on that? But, you know,
just no time to break a new band. Honestly, it's like I took a break. I think I ended the label formally. I don't remember if it was 2014 or 16. It's like I said, time's a blur. I'm getting old. But it must have been like 15 or 16. I had joined Integ at the time. I was like, you know, I can only put my, I have three kids, they're young, and it was like I can only put my eggs in one basket right now. Mm-hmm. And Integrity is just as much as playing music and going out. It's not really, when I was doing A389 at its peak, I would work an 8-hour job, come home and eat dinner, put my kids to bed, and then I would go to the warehouse and pack orders until 3 or 4 in the morning, sometimes all night, and then just go back to my other job. It was an insane time. That was like peak, like 2011 to 14. That was like full of hell and like nothing. Those records, those first band's records were coming out. So, you know, it was a very physically and mentally taxing endeavor. And when I came back to do the Coldest Life reissues a couple years ago, the idea was that it was just going to be that. You know, it's just like stuff that I could work on the layout, get the audio. It's stuff that I could just do at my own pace, and it's not, no one's waiting on it. Mm-hmm. It could be ready when it's ready, you know? And I think that's been really appealing. So, but what I was getting at was, during that window I was absent from releasing records, like a lot changed. And adding COVID, a lot more changed. And like things move incredibly fast. And dropping a new band out there is literally like dropping a paperclip into the ocean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And then gone. And maintaining that sort of presence is just not something I'm able to do, given the life that I live outside of music. And thankfully with Relapse Muscle, you know, hopefully it's dropping a paperclip into like a pond, or like, you know, a reservoir, something a little less daunting.
Well, they're getting the PRs out there, so you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, they do a great job. I'm totally appreciative of everything.
Yeah, they're on top of it. Well, the record comes out in, well, a month from today, actually, because it's the 14th today, so, you know, July 14th, which is, I guess, 4 weeks from now, so you're listening to this a month after.
Oh, yeah.
But, go pick up the album, or if you already have pre-ordered it, it's probably already at your doorstep sometime this week. But, I kind of wanted to get into some other things outside of In Rain, if you don't mind.
Absolutely, whatever you want.
Yeah, I wanted to start out with the A389 label stuff. Was
sure.
Did that come first, or were you in bands and doing music first?
Oh, my. No, I was doing bands way before that. I've been doing bands since the early 90s. And A389 didn't come about till 2004. Mm-hmm. So my lineage is a little scattered. I grew up in Toronto. I mean, I can do a quick recap if you want.
Yeah, just go ahead, because some of the listeners aren't going to be aware of it in general. So
yeah, growing up in Toronto in the 90s and doing bands, you know, things, they were just, you know, bands. I kicked around with my friends until we had a band called Dirge in the mid-90s. And we would play around quite a bit. That's when I got a taste for touring. And, you know, we played with bands like, you know, we were like a local band. We had a CD and a demo at the time, and we'd do stuff. We'd play with like bands that were smaller at the time, like Cryptopsy or Cataclysm, mm-hmm. or like, you know, younger Canadian bands.
Soul Small Storm, at Vermont, the time, yeah. Machine. Small at the time.
That's what was you know, our world at the time. And
right,
it was awesome.
I know.
And what happened was, on the road, Dirge had gotten into a bad accident in Quebec. Actually, I think it was after that Cryptopsy show. or one of those French bands, I can't remember. I'm sorry, I get them confused. Forgive me. But we ended up having to take some time off because we rolled our van and our drummer lost one of his fingers, and it was a catastrophe. It was a big deal. And we took some time off to regroup, and we came back. We started the band Day of Mourning, which pretty much became, you know, my most prolific era in my time that I lived in Canada. And we played a lot with Day of Mourning. We toured Canada. We toured the U.S. We did a ton of all over the place. It was amazing. But never made it to do a full U.S. or Europe tour, which is kind of where things kind of got stagnant. And of all people, I took an ad out. It was Brick to Life that took an ad out for, it wasn't 25 to Life though. It was Coming Correct. Mm. And keep in mind, this is a different time and a different Rick.
But, yeah.
How different? I'll leave that up to you. But, you know, it's a different time. And yeah, I took up the offer to go to Europe with him because I always wanted to go to Europe. So packed up all my shit. I had $300. I had a backpack full of clothes and my guitar, and that was it. It's my name, you know, and I just got on a Greyhound and hauled ass to Baltimore. And yeah, I did that Europe tour with them and did a few shows before I was like, you know, this isn't for me. But
Did you last the whole tour? Did you get the whole tour done at least?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, if I commit, I commit.
How crazy? I mean, it had to have been crazy just to be out there with Rick. I'm sure there's a lot of not safe for work. I'm sure there's a lot of NSFW conversation or, you know, stories from that time.
But it's also not the same guy that he is now. You know what I mean?
No, of course.
It's a different time. And it was a lot more, I like to think that it was a lot more innocent. It was hilarious. It was hilarious at all times. You know, there's a lot of like classic Rick moments. But, yeah. You know, like there's like, he used to live in this apartment above a liquor store in, I guess it's a neighborhood called Overly in Baltimore. I drive by it all the time with my kids. I'm like, that's the first place I lived when I moved here. But so he had this whole range of, it was this whole top of the building, which was like two floors full of like, you know, the dude was like, had a collection of, to end all collections. So the whole house just kind of like store all his stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And me kind of being, you know, we were friendly, but I was still a stranger living in this guy's house on his couch to protect his stuff. He was like, I was kind of like, delegated to one part of the apartment, which was like when you come through the back door, there was like a little living room with a kitchen, and then there was a door to the rest of the apartment, and that was it, right? So I was like, I had this little room with a kitchen and a way out, and if I got out and he wasn't home, I wasn't getting back in. I was sleeping on the pavement, and I had moved here and I didn't know anybody, and it was just kind of like, you know, it was a wild time. But
how old are you around this time?
Pardon me?
How old are you around this time?
Oh geez, I would have been in my early to mid 20s.
Okay.
You know, and like all I was like, you know what, it's a chance. I like 25. Everyone loved 25 at the time, you know. But
God, it must have been wild coming from Toronto to Baltimore though.
It was
in general culture shock, you know. And what year is this again?
You know what's funny is this was right after 9/11. This was maybe like a week or two after 9/11. Wow. So aside from the culture shock, America was in full force with like the full patriotic swing that came after 9/11. I remember distinguishly, distinctively, forgive me, I mumble sometimes, but two things I remember that were like what the fuck moments for me was Freedom Fries.
Yeah.
Remember there was like something where the French refused to participate. There was like some, they had some beef. They were just like, all right, you know, fuck
yeah,
you.
So all the people that were going to McDonald's were like, I want Freedom Fries.
And then seeing a TV show where they interviewed Scotty Ian from Anthrax about Anthrax.
Like the drug, not
like
the band.
Yeah. Letters with Anthrax. Yeah. He's just like, I don't know. It's kind of fucked up. You know, he didn't really have anything to say, right? So I'm just like, what am I doing here? It was wild. I'm like living on this dude's couch. Don't have a bathroom. I would have to go to Dunkin' Donuts to brush my teeth in the morning. And stuff. And if he wasn't awake, I wasn't getting back in. So I had to bring my stuff with me and be ready to just like, you know, hightail it and do what I was going to do for the day. But during that time, I made friends with Scott and Dougie that I ended up starting the band Slumlords with after that.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, I was a little more established. No, I'm sorry. You know, there was a little gap in between there, if I'm going to be thorough, where the guys from Next Step Up were like Baltimore legends. They have this other band called Wake Up Cold. You know, if you're local, you would know. I'm not sure how far outside of the reach that they really got. Aside from Europe, because I did go to Europe with them too, I ended up becoming a band whore. They would just go to Europe with bands as a hired gun.
There you go.
The makeup cold after that. But then I came back, I was like, I need to start my own thing. And that's when we started Slumlords. And we got Jeff Perlin from Breakdown, who happened to be living in Baltimore. So I'm at a show and I was like, you live in Baltimore? I was like, starstruck, because I love Breakdown, right? It was kind of nice. Cool for me. I mean, starstruck as you would be, finding, you know.
In the hardcore world. Yeah, in the hardcore world.
But it was cool. And so we did that, and Slumlords, you know, had a lot of great opportunities. We had to go to Europe. We toured. We kind of were like the first band around here that would like kind of only do fests. Because we were one of the first bands to pull the old guy card. Mm-hmm. So people wanted us to play. We had a record on Locking Out. And, you know, we were able to do cool shit like Positive Numbers or Sync with Cali or whatever. And, you know, that was a great time. We got to do a lot of cool stuff, but with minimal amount of movement, you know, reach a lot with moving little. But as that was winding down, I kind of started thinking about what I wanted to do next. And Pulling Teeth came after that. Mm-hmm. And Pulling Teeth was a band that went from 2005 to 2012. It was probably like, you know, my favorite band that I've been in. That was my baby. We started that from the ground up. We had started Pulling Teeth with the idea, we were still all pretty young, and we wanted a band. I wanted to make a band, much like N-Rain. I created Pulling Teeth out of the idea of picking the best guys from all the local bands.
Yeah.
All the guys with the same work ethic as I did, that we would get shit done. Because Pulling Teeth at its peak, like 10-inch, Vicious Skin era Pulling Teeth would play like 3 shows in one night. If we're playing New York and there was a show in Brooklyn we could play that night, and another show in a warehouse, we were there. We'd do nice. All 3.
Oh, yeah, cool. Yeah.
So, you know, we would not sleep and just do it, you know? So their work ethic at the early era, the first half of Pulling Teeth, was like sight to behold. It was awesome. And we did a lot of that. And I should mention that since Pulling Teeth started in 05, 04 is when 8389 started. See, there's going to be some cross-pollination. And 04, I started 8389 because Slumlords was playing those fests, like I mentioned, like in California and in Wilkes-Barre. Yeah. And I thought it would be a cool opportunity to get other bands out there that were in the same boat as us. I called it old guy bands. And we'd have bands that were like Everyday Dollars, which was like dudes that were in Killing Time and Uprise and Dark Side NYC, which is one of my favorites. That was the reason I was interested, because I love Dark Side. I love Rich. So we did Everyday Dollars, 7-inch, and Bring It On with a local band. And we, you know, Early Wisdom in Chains was another one. It was just more just like, you know, like older guy band stuff that we were using our leverage out there to help these other guys get on people's radar, you know. But as Pulling Teeth, kind of the tide shifted and Pulling Teeth came into the foreground, so did 8389's direction, and it became, you know, kind of like a metallic hardcore. It became what 8389 is known for. Like those early years were like hardcore stuff, and then it became like all about metal, metallic hardcore, death metal, grind, whatever, you know, a little bit of everything. If anyone follows the label, they know it's like it's everything from, you know, like joke bands about Pulling Teeth's drummer to like I Hate God and the Black Dahlia Murder.
Yeah.
And like, you know, a lot of first records for a lot of bands that are really popular now. So, you know, that started in 04 and kept picking up steam as Pulling Teeth became busier. That was a vehicle to keep 8389 getting bigger and bigger. And using, I always reinvested, you know, I always thought if one of my bands is popular and people help me, I want to do the same thing. So I was able to do with 8389 and like a lot of younger bands, give them their first shot at like doing stuff and getting out there. Many of which, like, you know, continue to do really great things, like Full of Hells, like headlining.
Right.
Now stage now, you know.
I feel like every couple months I'm posting like some fucking co-headlining or headlining tour announcement from them. Like they, in the last like handful of years, they've been one of the busiest bands, I think.
They're amazing. The work ethic is second to none.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's like when I think about like if all those bands were my kids, they're like the kids I'd be the most proud of, because they made the most out of it. But again, the Noism guys like ended up, you know, being in Exhumed and in Pig Destroyer, and they're one. Travis is playing Cavalera's band now on that tour they're doing for Morbid Visions and Bestial Devastation, which is insane to me, you know. So it was cool to see a lot of bands take that first step with me and continue down the righteous path and still be at it, doing like, you know, doing what they do their way and evolving way more into what I could have given them, you know. So it was like, I'm proud to be a small step on their story.
I was gonna ask like, what's your most crowning achievement? Is it a Full of Hell record, or is it like a Pulling Teeth record? Or
I mean, there's a lot of 8389 milestones. That like the Pulling Teeth hologram cover was a huge one, because no one has ever done one at that time, and no one has ever done one like that since. That was like the, I mean, people have done like a lenticular thing. I've seen the NWA one. How do you say it? Evil for Zagan? I'm not saying it the backwards way, but you know, that was the second one that went like, it's not as good. But they did a lenticular cover for it, and it just kind of wiggles. But that whole moving two-piece artwork was like the only thing of its kind. And it was like, at the time, it was like a $20,000 or $30,000 investment if you put that record out.
Yeah.
Just pulling teeth. This wasn't like fucking Metallica, right?
Yeah.
Deathwish wouldn't do it. We were on Deathwish at the time, and it was too big of a risk because, like I said, we weren't like one of their bigger bands. And I was doing the vinyl on A389, and I was like, you know what? If there's one thing that I can say about myself is if I decide I'm going to do something, I'll take it all the way, you know? And I'm like, I'm going to do this. And I remember going, have everything from getting Beckman to do the artwork that matches up to like, we had to have a consultation with Apple at the time to like, they had one of their engineers help put that thing together, how it moves the way it does. And I remember launching pre-orders and being like, if this totally flops and nobody buys this shit, I'm going to have to like just work a second job in a warehouse for a year just to fucking pay off the debt.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Took a shot and they sold out like right away, which is fucking great, you know? So that was really cool. As far as packaging, I think it was some of the more innovative packaging. They also had the pop-up center with the rats, which was cool. Like,
I mean, that's
like
cool. That, for people who collect vinyl, that's like super cool shit too, you know? And obviously you being someone who, excuse me, runs a label, you would, you know, be piped into all that kind of stuff. So all the innovation and all the cool things, obviously, like, it would make sense that you would be the one to do it.
Years of Kiss worship came
yeah, from, yeah.
You know? And also one of the cool things was, like, at the time, nobody was really putting out shoegaze bands on hardcore labels. I don't want to, like, you know, I'm going to humble brag for a minute, but we might have been the first.
You started that whole movement, huh?
That and record. It's called Dream Punks. I remember, like, they sent me a demo, and I'm like, this is fucking amazing, but what am I going to do with this? You know what I mean? And my friend Baron, who was one of my mail order helpers at the time, was like, you should just put it out. And I'm like, are you sure? I wanted to. It felt like the right thing to do. And I'm like, it's just good music. Good music is good music. And if the label's audience is anything like me, which I always like to think, I'm making records or putting out records for the other me's out there in the world. It's kind of like how I look at it. Then they would understand. They would appreciate it. And it went off great. You know what I mean? That sold multiple pressings. And that led to nothing coming out of the woodwork, and me doing a record with nothing, we ended up having a really successful career after that.
Yeah.
Being an early step for them was, you know, another huge accomplishment. One thing I wish I did that I tried to do and never got to pull off was I tried to press an end Dream Punks pressing. Remember when you would buy like hockey cards? I don't know where you're from, but when I was in Canada, so you would buy like, you know, a hockey card pack that would have the stick of gum in the middle. And I tried to press the end record on like that gum because it was like that shitty, like,
Hard. Well, I mean, like, it would get old and stale. Right? Yeah, it would get old and stale being in there.
They can definitely pull this off. And I was in talks with them to do it. And they're like, you know what? It's going to ship and it's going to melt. And you're just going to end up with a bunch of records that you can't do anything with. So that never happened. In hindsight, I kind of wish I did like a smaller, like, lathe cut type thing. It would be cool to have an edible record, was ultimately the goal.
Mm.
So if someone's listening and they want to take that idea, have at it. You know, just send me one. It works out.
I mean, on the bubblegum, that'd be fucking wild.
Yeah, it would have to be like that 1980s. It would have to legit be that 80s bubble, you know?
That's been dried out. Yeah, it's been dried and sitting for decades.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I Hate God was like a holy fuck moment. Black Dahlia Murder was a holy fuck moment. It was like a lot, you know? But Integrity being my favorite band from like the hardcore realm for like the entire time I've been into hardcore, getting to do with the Walpurgisnacht 7-inch with them, and, you know, forging that kinship where Dwight and I did a lot of stuff together after that moving forward, was really cool. So that's like a really defining moment for me.
Yeah.
And so yeah, as A39 is getting bigger and all the bands are kind of finding success, we had the fest every year. Everyone would come to Baltimore for in January, which was huge. We got Left 4 Dead to reunite, which is fucking huge. Another great milestone, you know, getting my hands on that discography and cleaning it up. You know what? I got to jump ahead. Sorry, ADHD moment. The greatest milestone is yet to come, because we got the original master tapes for Cold as Life, Declination of Independence.
Nice.
And anyone who's ever heard that record, came out in 2000, the drums sound like a trash can. The performance is incredible, but like the drums literally sound like St. Anger. It's like just a weird clicky, it's a hot mess. And we were able to go in and fix everything. We got Taylor Young to remix it.
Oh, nice. Cool.
It's fantastic. So really excited about that. But anyways, going back.
When does that come out though?
Hopefully at the end of this year. We got Dying Breed is coming up next. The discography for Dying Breed from Troy.
Mm-hmm.
and then The Cold Is Life, Declination, and it's kind of like the last thing on my grid for now, you know? Let's go back to just gardening and shit. I don't know. Figure it out. But as Pulling Teeth and Eighth Grade Hour were both culminating, I started having children. And that would have been 2010. And anyone that knows, you know, it takes a lot out of you. I had to quit doing bands and quit doing label stuff and get a real job that provided health insurance for my family, which, you know, wow, for the first time in 2010, that was the first time since like the 90s I had to get a straight 9 to 5, you
Right,
know.
yeah, bummer. That
You know,
was
it was an
speaking
adjustment.
of culture shock again.
Oh, it was brutal. You know what I mean? I don't think I had a friend at work. I've been at the same place for like 15 years now. And I don't think I made a friend at work until like 10 years into it because I just didn't talk to anybody. I don't want to talk about band stuff with people you work with. You know what I
Right.
mean? They appreciate, like, if there's a city paper article on the label or the bands and they'd want to talk about it and like ask me if I like Nickelback or whatever. You
Yeah,
know, I'm just
that's
like,
the thing. It's like they'll try to relate with you on music, but they're relating on a much more surface level of music, and we're way here at the bottom of the Marianas Trench almost,
I
and
truly
it's like
loathe it.
there's no middle ground here.
One of the greatest displeasures of life at my age is talking about music. I like honestly loathe it. Like with anybody, if anyone wants, like I call it talk, really talk. Like let's talk, let's really talk, you know. And you know they're like chop it up and chew the fat. I'm just like, you know, I said I don't want to do it. But anyways, so that all culminated, and I winded down. And 8389 came to an end because it was too much. Like I said, I was burning the candle at both ends. I was working like 20 hours a day between the two jobs, sleeping for 2 or 3 hours at a time. And it was just fucking miserable, you know? It was cool. The accomplishments were great, but it just, I couldn't keep up with it. And ended up kind of like, you know, didn't leave any of my bands hanging. A lot of them went over to Relapse, which started my relationship with Relapse. A couple went to Southern Lord, and others went others, and others broke up, and others did other things. You know what I mean? It was cool. But it was around the time, I had booked an Integrity show in 2015, and whoever they had playing lead guitar at the time, this was after the Melnix reunion. The Melnix reunion was in 2014. No, it was 2012 because that was the big one. I think. Jeez, I don't know. 2012 or 14? You might have to fact check that. I think it's 14. I'm almost sure it's 14 because that would have been 10 years. Melnix and Chris Hawthorne were in the band, so it was almost like the original lineup. And they had did that as a one-off, and after that, it left Wid with having to find new members. And the guy they had ended up bailing on them like a week before they were going to do the show. And I was like, dude, I know all the songs. I'll play. You know what I mean? So that was like a no-brainer. I've done
So
that with Ringworm a couple times too. You know, it's like
was
those
that the intro to the time spent there? Was that the foot in the door moment?
I mean, we talk all the time, so it was really
Oh
no thing.
yeah, but you stepping up to go like, ah, fuck it, I'll just do
Yeah,
it.
I'd done it with Ringworm a few times, and I was like, you know what? It's like those two bands' catalogs I know like the back of my hand, and we did it, and it was flawless. It was with the Jockum Brothers at the time. They were great musicians, so it was very easy to put together. And we did that show, and we did a few other shows, and that kind of evolved into what became the Howling era of Integrity, which started out with me, Joshy from ILSA, and Dwid doing everything, and then you know morphing into Francis from Devil Master in the band. I'm sorry, Darkest Prince. And you know, the Sax Man, everybody that came and went. And it was an amazing time. I've been an Integrity fan since the 90s, so seeing and being part of what was one of their more prolific eras as far as putting out music and playing shows, like we took that shit seriously. We like practiced a lot. We like always tried to deliver. And like I think we, you know, it was amazing. As a fan, I felt like, you know, we did it justice and it was really cool.
How much of
And
your, oh, sorry, go ahead.
no, I'm sorry, what were you gonna say?
Was gonna ask, like, how much of your input do you think, like, your personal and creative input on the record led to that, time of that time of the band?
I mean the
Like the
whole
Howling era, like you were suggesting, you know what I mean? Like you were
50-50,
going.
it was me, you know, Dwight and I literally we were a team, right? During that era, it was literally we decided everything together and we spent a lot of grueling hours working on that record. It took a long time. It nearly drove me insane, you know, but it was like it was worth it in the end. It came out awesome. And like we're both two very OCD, hyper focused, but on different things. So we would often like, you know, it's one day it's peace, one day it's war. It was real intense, but we were both really happy with the end result. And I think it was a really it was a true crossroads of my musical taste and him coming together and, like, you know, making something new that still sounded like Integrity, but wasn't a rehash of the other records, you know?
No.
It wasn't like Humanity is the Devil 2, Return of the Devil. It was like, you know, something totally different and cool. And we did a lot. We got to go to Japan. We got to go to Australia. And I remember coming back from Australia with Integrity and someone on the flight wearing a mask. I'm like, what's that shit about? You know what I mean? There's like, little did I know that that was like the beginning of
that's
what was
your
about
new life. Your new life's yeah. coming, sir.
Total foreshadowing. You know, it's crazy. And I came home, you know, and the world collapsed. And I just wrote and I wrote and I wrote. I wrote a ton of songs. I wrote songs for a ton of bands. I still have like a surplus, a bevy, whatever you want to call it. Tons of songs that I'm going to eventually do if I get around to it. You know, time getting less and less. But once the world opened up again, and it was time for Integrity to do things again, I had gotten divorced during the pandemic and had my three kids a lot of the time. You know, usually this was a time where, you know, the support system was minimal. So
Right.
My life looked totally different, you know? It was just like, I did a lot of the stuff, like, originally, like, you know, I always, you know, my kids were always my top priority, and I would shove everything else I had to do in between. But this required a lot more of, like, being available in case,
right?
You know, I just my it was a different, totally different approach to life.
Right.
It wasn't like someone else has got it covered. I can do this and we'll meet up. It was more just like, you know, fuck, I need to be here all the time now. And touring went out the window, and that's when I just wrote a bunch of songs. And then, you know, crossed avenues with Cold as Life, and that kind of picked up. And Integrity picked up on their own, and they got new guys that are fantastic. You know, I mean, they sound better than ever. You know, Dwid gets older and his voice sounds better. It's like, guys they got playing are way better than I am, you know, but it's like, it's cool to have been a part of it. And that takes us up to where End Rain starts, you know? That's where the story kind of
blossoms.
It's like one of those Tarantino movies where it goes from the back and comes forward.
Yeah.
In weird books, but yeah.
I want to touch a little bit on a couple questions because we kind of glossed over some stuff with the label. Because you had so many, you know, like we said, like you said, milestones and big bands. Or bands at the time that would go on to do a lot bigger things. Like, what was the, and, you know, I'm assuming it was mostly run by you personally. Like, how big was your staff at your biggest peak, you know?
One.
Yeah, so.
It was Superior Alex, that Alex Shaw, that is now the noise guy and Pig Destroyer.
Hmm.
You know, he was my right-hand man for many years. He spent many an all-nighter with me packing orders. And I have to mention Baron as well. Baron Kirkpatrick, he plays in a band called War Games, another band called League Shores, local friend. Great dude, you know, a great friend. And, like, just these are dudes out there, like, went above and beyond, you know.
Yeah.
I showed up. I was just happy to be there. Like, no problem. We're pulling an all-nighter in a freezing cold storage unit where we had to, like, steal electricity from the next building. We'd roll in with, like, 20 extension cords and set up power bars, and we'd have these. Because, you know, they call it climate controlled, but as soon as those lights go out and the staff leaves, that shit's dropping at, like,
yeah,
temperatures, right? No one's there to know. But we're in there, and it's, like, freezing. You know what I mean? Like, brutal. Like, we're in, like, winter coats, and it's still brutal. So we devised this plan to drive back home and get as many extension cords as we can and, you know, run them to the next building and bring all these space heaters in. And I'll never forget, you know, we're, like, I think it was Baron. Baron got, he flew too close to the sun. He's, like, let's just turn on one more space heater. And he hit it. Everything popped blue, you know?
Yeah.
We're in total darkness and
cold as shit.
No heat, you know, it's brutal. But these were the guys. These are the guys I surrounded myself with.
And all those really... and all those people that were getting those records in, you know, weeks time from you packing them would have no idea what you have gone through.
Oh, the blood, sweat, and tears, man. It's a story within itself, for sure.
That's kind of funny. Yeah, those are always funny. Like when you look back about, like, you know, because I also have stories where you steal power for one reason or another. So it's just funny, you know, you think back on those times. But my question was going to be, like, at what level does a band get too big for, you know, for you? Like, and as a label owner, you know, someone who's working with bands, is it more like, is it more like a proud dad moment, or is it kind of like a, oh shucks, I wish I could, you know, kind of handle this going forward, but obviously I don't have the resources or time, or, you know.
It's a great question, and it's a little bit of both. You know? It's always bittersweet, you know what I mean? It's a little stab in the heart when they move on, but it's also understandable. I think it's like, I think about like a Full Health, for instance. They're like, there's no way I could have kept up with Full Health was becoming, you know? Mm-hmm. Full Health were like, by the time I did those first two records, and they were already like touring most of the year and just growing and growing. And then I was still in the loop for the Merzabout collab. I did the vinyl for that. And Chris Bruni from Profound Lore, an old friend of mine from Canada, small world in this music world. But he ended up doing the CD, and he took that next tier. You know what I mean? He helped them get like established on a somewhat of a middle tier. And then, you know, I helped get them onto Relapse when it came around full circle again. So, you know, I've always kind of been behind the curtain helping these guys out. And it's, you know, I don't want anything for it. I'm just happy to see my friends succeed, and like guys that I know are really, you know, I could be a label guy, and like I've been a label guy and a band guy for so long, I could tell you like band guys are the worst. They always want something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just like it was your friend because they want you to do something, and then when you can't anymore, you're not like, you see an artist, see you later. But yeah, you know, I just wanted to always make sure that those dudes were like set up and in a good place, because I showed them everything I knew, which was pretty limited, and then it became something where they were showing me stuff, because it was like the student had superseded the teacher, you know? Yeah. And Noisem was another one, but it burned out so quickly. Noisem went from like being teenagers that were playing like, you know, the Sidebar, which is like this little dingy 100 maximum stuff place, like local death metal bands. They were just like kids, they were in high school, and they like skyrocketed to like touring with Carcass a couple times, being on the cover of Decibel. Shit was going big.
Yeah.
I mean, it was lightning in a bottle. Like, to see them at that time was unbelievable. That first wave, like, the Agony Defined era was untouchable. And honestly, that's another one where, you know, I negotiated a contract for them in Relapse, too. And by negotiated, I was like, hey, do you want to put this out? Yeah. I don't want to sound like I'm, like, this mastermind. It was very just like, so how's it going? You know, like, appreciate it. Just making sure they're in good hands.
Right. Is it something like, you don't have the financial resources to like put out the amount of vinyl or the recording, or is it like the marketing? You don't have the ability for the marketing, or
yeah,
like what is it? Okay, so it's
the manpower. The budgeting thing was never an issue because we could sell enough records to cover what needs to get covered, and everyone gets paid. You know what I mean? But it's more like, yeah, how many times do you want to run the 5 mile track when you know you can do the 10 mile or the 15 or the 50 or the 100? You know. There's no reason to set the ceiling so low and just exist in this little bubble when you can accomplish so much more. And Full Hell's proof that, you know, there's no limit to what you can do. And Nothing, too. You know, I've seen Nothing do insane things. And, like, yeah, no. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of a pride sting when you're like, oh, it's like a dad thing, too, when you're like, oh, they don't need me anymore. You know, you
get kind of
bummed out about it. But at the end of the day, it's the right decision. And to see them succeed is really satisfying. And, like, to still see those bands. When I see a festival and I see like a Full of Hell or Nothing or still like top billers or Integrity is still headlining stuff, it makes me feel good because I had like a small part in keeping that alive, you know?
Yeah.
And those bands mean a lot to me and their friendships mean a lot to me. So it was never really a business agreement, you know what I mean? It was always more just like a labor of love that like made us all a bit of money and like we're able to keep things going, you know?
Yeah. When you think back to early days, like, did you ever think, like, hardcore would be where it's at today? Like, what was your for? Like, how long did you think hardcore would last from, like, you know, when you were a young kid? Like, how long, like, could you see the forecast? Like, could you see how long it could be? Or did you think it was going to stick around for another 20, 30 years?
I mean, this is I think I have a few different tiers to answer that. I think like first off I'd like to say that it's a young person's game, 100%. Yeah. The young person has the energy.
Is it really a young person's game because it's there's no older people yet? I mean, because the, you know, as the time moves on, those younger kids are going to turn, like, you know.
I was saving that for the second tier.
Okay, go ahead.
So I think it really flourishes when it's in the young person's possession. When we were young, we were like in that band Dirge I was talking about, and we were like kids growing up in Toronto, like, you know, like in high school, none of us had driver's license. We used to like take all of our shit, Marshall's fucking stacks and drum sets, onto the bus into the city, which was like an hour ride, onto subway trains to play a show of Gasworks, which was, you would probably have seen in Wayne's World, the club. Yeah. We play in Wayne's World. That was in Toronto that we would play at sometimes. But Yeah, like so we would literally like have, you know, five of our buddies and all of us take all our shit. You couldn't pay me to do that now, right? But like when you're young, you have that hunger. And that's why it's a young person's game. I think like they wanna they're gonna sleep on people's floors. They're gonna do it. I did it. And I think it's magical. It's a magical period. And at the
Certainly is.
same time, it keeps it fresh. New people come in. And then there's the other side of the coin, which is like, you know, and this is kind of a weird thing because, yeah, you can make a career out of it. Many of my friends have, in a weird, bizarre twist of fate, I have too. You can call it that, you know, it's a feather in my hat. I wouldn't call it a career. But it's like, I don't know. I'm glad I can go see Integrity anytime I want, or I can go see Despise You, or I can go see fucking Earth Crisis if I want to, right? But like, it's also like a weird backlash where people used to idolize all the old bands, and now there's like a real wild like ageism thing going on where it's like nobody wants old people like old bands, but all the other people are like, yo, you guys are old, you know, just take a
Yeah.
hike. It's a real weird division.
I think I
Not everywhere.
it is the reason I ask is because I feel like and I'm sure you probably feel the same way in some aspects, but hardcore is on like this very big like TikTok and Instagram and social media, and the younger generation have definitely gotten a hold of hardcore in one form or the other, whether it's through like a band like Turnstile or it's some kind of like mosh content, crowd kill content that they've seen, like norm, like the normal audience has seen, and they're like, "What the fuck is this?" So I feel like hardcore is in it's a big upswing right now, and
Right, it's a
it's a
machine.
lot different than when, you know, I was a kid.
Those kids aren't going to care that there's an N-Rain record, you know? But it's like, at the same time, you know, Turnstile universe is an amazing place, and it's like I'm glad that that exists, and like, it makes me happy. You know what I mean? It's like you leave high school or you leave whatever. Life moves in phases, and when you look back at your era, and it's like, you know, it's like those were your that was our that was like my time or your time, and now it's like their time. These young kids, they're having a great time, and
And
like,
they're still having beat down bands and, you know, crossover
yeah,
bands and stuff that aren't as big as Turnstile that they're getting turned on to. But like what I'm saying is like Turnstile and the Taco Bell commercial just like sends them down a little rabbit hole, you know, it kind of
it's
nudges them
great.
down there.
Yeah, it makes me really happy for everybody involved. You know what I mean? It's like. It's kind of extension of just seeing other people. It's like this is the dad part, where it's like seeing other people's kids do well. You know, so just like you know, it's like it's cool. It makes me really happy. And but yeah, you know, it also kind of made like a weird like sub genre to hardcore, where it's just like all these older bands all of a sudden have like it exists in a different realm. And we're like the classic rock of hardcore,
Yeah,
you know.
it's really weird. Like even like you know, like Hatebreed. I've been able to like witness Hatebreed from like a not an infant stage because I wasn't like an early person to the Hatebreed you know, cult, but I did find them like right before Perseverance and Under the Knife and around that time and stuff like that. And then of course when Perseverance came out, I was like fully on board. But it's been interesting to see like bands like Hatebreed or like other bands turn into legacy bands over time.
Legacy band is a perfect way to put it. Yeah, and
And
it deserves.
I never thought that I'd be listening to Hatebreed for 20 plus years. You know what I'm saying? Like
You're right. The
I didn't
longevity.
think about it.
It's wild, but you know, it's like I think a lot of people like you and I, music connects you to a certain part of your life. You know what I mean? And I think that listening to like Hatebreed, throwing the Under Knife 7-inch on for me takes me back to being in the van with Dirge or with Day Morning with my friends at that time. You know, and it's like I don't want to cheapen it by calling it nostalgia because they're making current music that's great. You know what I mean? And they're fucking hard workers, and they're like. They set the bar for so many different things that like can achieve as a band in this like, little microcosm. But you're right, and it's just weird. It's almost like you know, like I said, it's like the older bands are like the classic rock bands now. You know what I mean? We're the guys in the Led Zeppelin shirt and the Black Sabbath shirt trying to like smoke pot behind the school or whatever. But like, I think there's room for all of it because I come from a world where it's like I never discover music when it's hot and new. Stuff like the Hatebreed 7-inch, like Integrity, when I was a kid and it was new, yeah, that worked out. But as I got older, I love finding old stuff that's new to me, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't get in a bath until like way after, you know, or like.
I'm in that mode right now too. A lot of those bands, because you know, and I've said this many times on this podcast, so I apologize. But you know, early days, early scene days when gatekeeping was still like very prevalent and like a very big part of the scene, I feel like, it made me not check out a lot of bands. And then as time has gone on, you know, like obviously personal taste changed too. So I started rechecking out bands that I just didn't like back in the day. And then obviously like that opened up a whole different world. But then I started checking out bands that I like was like, oh, well, I wasn't like really allowed to like that band, but let me check it out, you know. And oh, that opened up a whole different world. So, you know, yeah, it was kind of, it's kind of fun.
Discovery, you know, like a big one for me when I was like a teenager was Fishbone. That was just like opened the door to so much like ska and funk and like other genres that were like foreign to me at the time. I was a heavy metal kid, you know, I like heavy metal and horror movies, and that was it. And like, you know, kind of like bridging me into that, and then like hearing like a band like Anthrax or Metallica that bridges me over to like MOD and DRI, which would bridge me over to Agnostic Front and Biohazard. And it's like, it was a constant, and it still is, you know. I mean, I still find stuff I like that's old, sometimes that's new, but I never find out when it's new and hip. I can never be the tastemaker that's like, you know, it's always just like I'm the last guy that's like, hey guys, if you like, you know, heard this, and like,
yeah, like 10 years ago, man.
But it's okay, I think, you know, there's no rules, do whatever you want.
No, for sure. I and again, I think it's awesome that, but I don't know if I agree with, like, you think that the older bands are kind of in this different category for the younger kids. Because I also think, like, one of the things is, like, people in bands listen to, like, I'm sorry, people that listen to these bands when they, like, listen to band interviews or podcasts or stuff like that, like, that is their, like, album cover or thanks list or whatnot, because all of that music is digitally ingested,
right?
Or, you know, like, so they don't really get the whole, like, where we had like sat with the CD for a while and flipped through the pages and the album artwork and all this kind of stuff where you see what band shirt he's wearing or what bands were thanked in the thank you liner notes and stuff like that. So I think fans of bands listen to like this type of online content, and then they kind of search backwards that way too for what bands are like mentioning their influences are or bands they listen to. And I think a lot of like, I honestly think a lot of newer bands listen to a lot of older stuff because, you know, I don't know, but I've never really met someone that likes Bolt Thrower, but everyone says they like Bolt Thrower, you know. So
I love,
like,
Bolt Thrower.
Yeah, but like every new band, you know, like every new younger kid, I'm like, How do you even find Bolt? Like, how do you even find Bolt Thrower? You know what I'm saying?
I pretended to be sick at one of my best friend's weddings so I can go see Bolt Thrower twice. But they played Maryland Death Fest, so I managed to get out of there a couple times and catch them. And Integrity.
Were you in your full on like wedding attire?
No, I got a quick change of clothes. But oh man, and we played with Memoriam in Europe with Integrity once when I met Carl. I told him that story. He was amused. I was like, I left my best friend's wedding to come see you guys play. And he's just like, whoa. But no, it's, I agree with you on part of that, but I also feel like, you know, and, you know, this is going to be some old man yelling at cloud shit, but I think society's devolved where the attention's, no one's going to listen to a 3-hour album,
of course,
watch a 3-hour movie.
Uh-huh.
I think like social media and like Instagram and TikTok culture has made everyone's attention span shrink. They want the cliff notes, you know?
Yeah. I agree.
A lot of people are going to really like absorb everything that music. I think our generation of people that like listen to music and really truly digest every last detail and like leaves you wanting more and like grab another branch off another tree and explore that. I don't want to say it's completely lost because I still meet people that are, you know, refreshingly of that mindset. But
right,
I think
right.
Like fast food, you know what I mean? I think more people want the instant gratification.
Right. You know, I mean, I think like, there's just more people out there. So there's more people out there doing it. I don't want to say the wrong way, but, you know, that way.
It's their way.
Yeah,
you know,
that way.
And that's totally cool.
But, yeah, like you're saying, the attention spans are very short. And, I mean, you see it in every asset of all sorts of industries, not just, like, how can you get someone to listen to a whole record. So
my friend Rich from Wisdom and Chains would tell me, put your best songs at the beginning because no one's ever going to get all the way to the end. And I'm just like, no, fuck that. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
This is my masterpiece. I'm going to lay it out the way I want it. You know, and
that does suck too. Cause like, you know, and you kind of see, and unfortunately you do kind of see that in some kind of, some albums layout.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas like the front half of the record is like just chock full, but then you get to the back half and it's not as good. Whereas if like you sprinkle that throughout, those lower, those, you know, those not as good songs don't stick out as poorly, you know, all together if they're chopped in between like singles, or, you know, if it's if the album track list is structured appropriately.
But if you look at like a Spotify, like a, you know, stats,
right,
you always see the first songs have like the highest plays, and then it like kind of goes down.
Oh yeah, drastically. Oh, depending on the record, depending on the record of the band, yes.
Yeah, but for the, you know, like generally speaking, that's kind of how it goes. But I'm like, you know, I refuse. I always lay out the record and plan it out where it's like, a trade secret is I model every record after AC/DC, Highway to Hell. I've always have. Listen to every record I've ever been on. It kind of follows the same template as Highway to Hell does. Starts off strong, kind of, you know, it just follows the same energy all the way across. And it's something that, you know, that's always the standard. I think a perfectly sequenced album such as Highway to Hell is like worth its weight in gold. It's like the biggest, one of the best lessons out there, is to find an album that like you can listen to start to finish and figure out why it is, you know? Not necessarily in the songs or the style, but just how it's arranged and like what keeps your interest, you know?
Yeah. How big of a influence is Angus on your guitaring, your love for guitar and playing?
First person I ever, that's why I bought a guitar when I was in sixth grade, because of Angus Young. I saw the video for Back in Black and on Much Music at the time, and I was like, I want to do that. And dreamt of getting an SG, dreamt of being able to, like, you know, to play like he does, and I still can't, but I mean, like, it's still, I got to do some pretty cool stuff, you know?
Yeah,
it's
all right. You did okay. You did okay with it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Dom, man, it's been a quick hour. It goes by quick.
Wow, I know, right?
Yeah. Jeez. It goes by quick. Well, I won't keep you for much longer then.
Hey, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
No problem, man. Yeah, best of luck, and you still are doing A389, right? That's still going on.
Dying Breed, Take My Soul, Give Me Graves is going to be out when this podcast comes out. You'll be able to, if you love, like, fuck, it's like the best qualities of like Hatebreed and 100 Demons and Marauder,
nice.
Or like a newer band like God's Hate.
Nice.
It's like fucking Dying. I mean, God's Hate named themselves after a Dying Breed song, if that gives you any indication of how great Dying Breed is.
Yeah,
and that's true. Majestic, you know what I mean? And then we got that Coldest Life Declination remix, and, you know, beyond that, who knows? Let's wait and see, I guess.
Cool.
Maybe we'll know by the time this airs.
Cool. See. Yeah, yeah. And don't be so humble. Obviously, you have a thumbprint on this little hardcore lore as the, you know, the storyline of hardcore. So don't be so humble. You have a little saying and a little piece of that. So you've done well. You've done well for yourself. You've done well for the community as well. You've done a lot for other people and other bands. And, you know, you should get a little. I'll give you a little flowers now. How about that?
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Check out In Rain. Album drops this week. Well, technically this week if you're listening to this, but check it out. Relapse Records. Sure. And yeah, man. Well, hopefully we'll see some In Rain soon live, but, you know, we'll leave that up to you guys or whatnot.
If it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
And it'll be really special.
All right, festivals. Get to
call
saying
in. Good, but it'll be special.
Yeah.
All right.
Take it easy, Dom. Have a great night.
Thanks again. Take care.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.